Welcome to Theology Breakfast with Redeemer Baptist Church. This morning, we'll be reading a sermon by Thomas Chalmers, a pastor, a Scottish pastor in the 1800s. And the sermon is titled, The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. It's based off of this text, 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. There are two ways in which a practical moralist may attempt to displace from the human heart its love of the world. First, either by demonstrating of the world's emptiness, so that the heart will be persuaded simply to withdraw its gaze from an object that is not truly worthy of it. Or second, by setting forth another object, namely God, as more worthy of the heart's attachment, so that the heart won't be persuaded to give up an old affection, which will have nothing to succeed it, but rather to exchange an old affection for a new one. My purpose is to show that from the constitution of our nature, the first method is altogether inadequate and ineffectual, and that the second method will alone suffice for the rescue and recovery of the heart from the wrong affection that domineers over it. After having accomplished this purpose, I will attempt to give a few practical observations. First, love's two directions, desire and indulgence. Love may be regarded in two different directions. The first is when love's object is at a distance and it becomes love in a state of desire. The second is when love's object is in possession and then it becomes love in a state of indulgence. Under the impulse or state of desire, man feels himself urged onward in some path or pursuit of activity to gratify the desire. The faculties of his mind are put into busy exercise. In the steady direction of one great and engrossing interest, his attention is recalled from the many daydreams into which it might otherwise have wandered, and the powers of his body are forced away from a laziness in which it otherwise might have languished. That time of desire is crowded with activity of mindful exercise, which without some object of keen and devoted ambition might have driveled along in successive hours of weariness and distaste. And though hope does not always enliven and success does not always crown his career of pursuing to gratify the desire, yet in the midst of this very variance between hope and success, and with the alternations of occasional hopelessness and disappointment, the machinery of the whole man kept in a sort of pleasant play and upheld in that tone and temper which are most agreeable to the pursuit of the gratification of the desire. Insomuch that if through the destruction of that desire which forms the originating principle of all this movement, the machinery of the whole man were to stop and to receive no impulse from another desire substituted in its place, the man would be left with all his propensities to action in a state of most painful and unnatural abandonment. A sensitive being suffers and is in violence if, after having thoroughly rested from his fatigue or been relieved from his pain, he continue in possession of powers without any excitement of these powers. If he possess a capacity of desire without having an object of desire, or if he have a spare energy upon his person without a counterpart and without a stimulus to call it into operation. The misery of such a condition is often realized by him who is retired from business, or who is retired from law, or who is even retired from the occupations of the chase and of the gaming table. Such is the demand of our nature for an object in pursuit that no accumulation of previous success can extinguish it, and thus it is that the most prosperous businessman and the most victorious general and the most fortunate gamester, when the labor of their respective vocations has come to a close, are often found to languish in the midst of all their acquisitions, as if out of their kindred and rejoicing element. It is quite in vain, with such a constitutional appetite for employment in man, to attempt cutting away from him the spring or the principle of one employment without providing him with another. The whole heart and habit will rise in resistance against such an undertaking. The unoccupied female who spends the hours of every evening at some risky effort knows as well as you that the financial gain or the honorable triumph of a successful contest are altogether small and trivial. It is not such a demonstration of vanity as this that will force her away from her dear and delightful occupation. The habit cannot be so displaced as to leave nothing but a negative and cheerless vacancy behind it, though it may be so supplanted as to be followed up by another habit of employment, to which the power of some new affection has constrained her. It is willingly suspended, for example, on any single evening, should the time that is inclined to be allotted to gaining require to be spent on the preparations of an approaching assembly of church, family, company for hospitality. The ascendant power of a second affection will do. What no exposition, however forcible, of the folly and worthlessness of the first ever could effectuate. And it is the same in the great world. We shall never be able to arrest any of its leading pursuits by a naked demonstration of their vanity. It is quite in vain to think of stopping one of these pursuits in any one way, but by stimulating another. In attempting to bring a worldly man intent and busied with the prosecution of his objects to a dead stand, we have not merely to encounter the charm which he annexes to these objects, but we have to encounter the pleasure which he feels in the very prosecution of them. It is not enough, then, that we dissipate the charm or by a moral or and eloquent and affecting exposure of its elusiveness. We must address to the eye of his mind another object with a charm powerful enough to dispossess the first of its influences and to engage him in some other prosecution as full of interest and hope and pleasant activity as the former. It is this which stamps a lack of power on all moral and passionate speech about the insignificance of the world. A man won't agree to the misery of, one, being without an object, because the object is of little importance, or of, two, being without a pursuit, because that pursuit ends in some meaningless or elusive attainment. Then he will voluntarily submit himself to torture, because that torture will be of short duration. If lacking desire and lacking exertion altogether is a state of violence and discomfort, then the present desire with its correspondent action of exertion is not to be got rid of simply by destroying it. It must be substituted by another desire and another line or habit of exertion in its place. And the most effectual way of withdrawing the mind from one object is not by turning it away upon unhappy and empty vacancy, but by presenting to its attention another object still more alluring. These remarks apply not merely to love considered in its state of desire or an object not yet obtained. They apply also to love considered in its state of indulgence or free gratification with an object already in possession. It is rare that any of our tastes are made to disappear by a mere process of natural extinction. At least it is very rare that it is done through the instrumentality of reasoning. It may be done by excessive pampering, but it is almost never done by the mere force of mental determination. But what cannot be destroyed may be dispossessed, and one taste may be made to give way to another, and to lose its power entirely as the reigning affection of the mind. It is thus that the boy ceases at length to be the slave of his appetite. But it is not because a manlier taste has brought it into subordination and that the youth ceases to idolize pleasure. Rather, it is because, number one, the idol of wealth has become stronger and gotten the ascendancy, and that even the love of money ceases to have the mastery over the heart of many a thriving citizen, but it is because it's drawn into, number two, the whirl of city polities, and another affection has been wrought into his moral system, and he is not lorded over by the love of power. There is not one of these transformations in which the heart is left without an object. The heart's desire for one particular object may be conquered, but as to its desire for having some one object or other, this is unconquerable. The heart's adhesion to that on which it has fastened the preference of its attention cannot willingly be overcome by the rending away of a simple separation. It can be done only by the application of something else, to which it may feel the adhesion of a still stronger and more powerful preference. Such is the grasping tendency of the human heart that it must have something to lay hold of, and which, if forced away without the substitution of another something in its place, would leave a void and a vacancy as painful to the mind as hunger is to the natural system. It may be dispossessed of one object or of any, but it cannot be emptied or made unhappy of all. Let there be a breathing and a sensitive heart, but without a liking and without affinity to any of the things that are around it, and in a state of cheerless abandonment, it would be alive to nothing but the burden of its own consciousness and feel it to be intolerable. It would make no difference to its owner whether he dwelt in the midst of a happy and goodly world or placed afar beyond the outskirts of creation. He dwelt in a solitary unit in dark and empty nothingness. The heart must have something to cling to, and the heart will never, by its own voluntary consent, so deprive itself of its attachments so that there shall not be one remaining object that can draw or ask for it. The misery of a heart deprived in this way of all taste for that which inclined to serve its enjoyment is strikingly exemplified in those who, satisfied with indulgence, have been so assaulted, as it were, with the variety and the poignancy of the pleasurable sensations they have experienced, that they are at length fatigued out of all capacity for sensation whatsoever. The disease of no desire at all, or depression, is more frequent in the French metropolis, where amusement is more exclusively the occupation of the higher classes, than it is in the British metropolis, where the longings of the heart are more diversified by the resources of business and politics. There are the devoted followers of fashion who, in this way, have at length become the victims of fashionable excess, in whom the very multitude of their enjoyments has at last extinguished their power of enjoyment, who, with the gratifications of art and nature at command, now look upon all that is around them with an eye of tastelessness. These continually hit with delights of sense and of splendor, even to weariness, and incapable of higher delights, have come to the end of all their perfection, and like Solomon of old, found it to be vanity and vexation. The man whose heart has been turned into a desert like this can affirm for the insupportable weakness which must ensue when one affection is thus plucked away from the heart without another to replace it. It is not necessary that a man receive pain from anything in order to become miserable. It's barely enough that he looks with distaste to everything. And in that asylum, which is the repository of minds so broken, and where the organ of feeling, the heart, as well as the organ of intellect, the mind, has been impaired, it is not in the cell of loud and frantic outcries where we shall meet with the height of mental suffering. But the height of mental suffering is found in the individual who surpasses others in wretchedness beyond all his fellows, who, throughout the whole expanse of nature and society, one, meets not an object that has all the power to arrest or to interest him, two, who neither in earth beneath nor in heaven above knows of a single charm to which his heart can send forth one desirous or responding movement, number three, to whom the world in his eye, a vast and empty desolation, has left him nothing but his own consciousness to feed upon, dead to all that is outside of himself, and number four, is alive to nothing but to the load of his own sluggish and useless existence. It will now be seen, perhaps, why it is that the heart keeps its present affections with so much persistence when the attempt is to do them away by a mere process of removal. It will not agree to be emptied. The strong man whose dwelling place is there may be compelled to give way to another occupier, But unless another stronger than he has power to dispossess and to succeed him, he will keep his present lodgment inviolable. The heart would revolt against its own emptiness. The heart could not bear to be so left in a waste and cheerless lack of taste. The moralist, who tries such a process of dispossession as this upon the heart, is prevented at every step by the recoil of its own natural mechanics. You have all heard that nature abhors a vacuum. Such at least is the nature of the heart, that though the room which is in it may change one inhabitant for another, it cannot be left empty without the pain of most intolerable suffering. 1. It is not enough then to argue the folly of an existing affection. 2. It is not enough in the terms of a forcible or an affecting demonstration to make good the vanishing nature of its object. 3. It may not even be enough to associate the threats and the terrors of some coming vengeance with the indulgence of it. The heart may still resist the every application by obedience to which it would finally be conducted to a state so much at war with all its appetites as that of downright exhaustion caused by a lack of nourishment. So, to tear away an affection from the heart so as to leave it bare of all its attention and of all its preferences is a hard and hopeless undertaking, and it would appear as if the powerful engine of dispossession alone only brings the mastery of another affection to bear upon it. We don't know of a more sweeping decree of prohibition upon the affections of nature than that which is delivered by the apostle in the verse before us. Again, it's 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. To bid a man into whom there has not yet entered the great and ascendant influence of the principle of regeneration, to bid him withdraw his love from all the things that are in the world, is to bid him give up all the affections that are in his heart. The world is the all of an unbelieving natural man or woman. He or she doesn't have a taste nor a desire that doesn't point to something placed within the confines of his or her visible horizon. He or she loves nothing above the world, and he or she cares for nothing beyond the world. And to bid him or her to love not the world is to pass a sentence of expulsion on all the inhabitants of his or her heart. To estimate the magnitude and the difficulty of such a surrender, let us only think that it were just as difficult to convince him or her not to love wealth, which is but one of the things in the world, as to influence on him or her to set willful fire to his or own her own property. This he or she might do with sore and painful reluctance if he or she saw that the salvation of his or her life hung upon it. But this he or she would do willingly if he or she saw that a new property of tenfold value was instantly to emerge from the wreck of the old one. In this case, there is something more than the mere displacement of an affection. There is the overbearing of one affection by another. But to rid his or her heart of all love for the things of the world without the substitution of another love in its place is to him or her a process of unnatural violence, as to destroy all the things that he or she has in the world and to give him or her nothing in its place. So that if not loving the world is indispensable to one's Christianity, then the crucifixion of the old man is not too strong of a term to mark that transition in his life when all old things are done away and all things become new, regeneration. We hope that by this time you understand the lack of power that results from a mere demonstration of this world's insignificance. This method's sole practical effect, if it had any, would be to leave the heart in a state which is unsupportable, and that is a mere state of nakedness and negation. You may remember the fond and unbroken persistence with which your heart has often returned to pursuits over the utter frivolity of which it sighed and wept but yesterday. The arithmetic of your short-lived days may on Sunday at church make the clearest impression upon your understanding, and from your rancid bed of death may the preacher cause a voice to descend in rebuke and mockery on all the pursuits of earthliness. And as the preacher pictures before you the fleeting generations of men with the absorbing grave, whether all the joys and interests of the world hasten to their sure and speedy obscurity, may you, touched and solemnized by the preacher's argument, feel for a moment as if on the eve of a practical and permanent emancipation from a sense of so much emptiness. But the Monday morning comes, and the business of the world and the objects of the world and the moving forces of the world come along with it, and the machinery of the heart, in virtue of which it must have something to grasp or something to adhere to, brings the heart under a kind of moral necessity to be actuated just as before, and in utter repulsion to guardians returns to a state so unkindly as that of being frozen out of both delight and desire. The heart feels all the earth and urgency of its inclined requests, nor in the habit and life of the whole man can we detect so much as one symptom of the new creature, so that the church, instead of being to him a school of obedience, has been a mere leisurely place for the luxury of a passing theatrical emotion. And the preaching, number one, which is mighty to compel the attendance of multitudes, number two, which is mighty to still and to solemnize the hearers into a kind of tragic sensibility, and number three, which is mighty in the play of variety and vigor that it can keep up around the imagination, is not mighty to the pulling down of strongholds. The love of the world cannot be erased by a mere demonstration of the world's worthlessness. But may it not be supplanted by the love of that which is more worthy than itself? The heart cannot be prevailed upon to part with the world by a simple act of resignation. But may not the heart be prevailed upon to admit into its preference another who shall subordinate the world and bring it down from its inclined ascendancy? If the throne which is placed in the heart must have an occupier, and the tyrant that now reigns has occupied it wrongfully, tyrant it may be that the tyrant may not leave a heart that would rather keep the tyrant than be left in desolation. But may the heart not give way to the lawful sovereign, God, appearing with every charm that can secure his willing admittance into the heart and taking unto himself his great power to subdue the moral nature of man and reign over it? In a word, if the way to disengage the heart from the positive love of one great and ascendant object is to fasten it in positive love to another, then it is not by exposing the worthlessness of the former, but by addressing to the mental eye the worth and excellence of the latter, object that all old things are to be done away and all things are to become new. To obliterate all our present affections by simply eliminating them so as to leave the seat of the affections unoccupied would be to destroy the old character and to substitute no new character in its place. But when they take their departure upon the entrance of other visitors, number one, when they resign their influence to the power and the predominance of new affections, number two, when abandoning the heart to solitude, they merely give place to a successor who turns it into as busy a residence of desire and interest and expectation as before. There is nothing in all this to successfully oppose or to overbear any of the laws of our sentient nature, our consciousness. And we see how, in the fullest accordance with the mechanism of the heart, a great moral revolution may be made to take place upon it. Countering the ineffectual preaching described above, Chalmers begins to talk about the effective preaching of the gospel. This, we trust, will explain the operation of that charm which accompanies the effectual preaching of the gospel. The love of God and the love of the world are two affections, not merely in a state of rivalship, but in a state of enmity. And that's so irreconcilable that they cannot dwell together in the same heart. We have already affirmed how impossible it is for the heart, by any innate elasticity of its own, to cast the world away from it and thus reduce itself to a wilderness. The heart is not made that way. And the only way to dispossess it of an old affection is by the expulsive power of a new one. Nothing can exceed the magnitude of the required change in a man's character when commanded, as he is in the New Testament, to love not the world, no, nor any of the things that are in the world, for this so comprehends all that is dear to him in existence as to be equivalent to a command of self-annihilation. But the same Bible that dictates so mighty an obedience to, quote, love God, unquote, places within our reach as mighty an instrument of obedience, namely acting upon a new affection. The Bible brings for admittance to the very door of our heart an affection which, once seated upon its throne, will either subordinate every previous inhabitant object of the affection of the heart, or bid it, the old object of the affection, away. Beside the world, the Bible places before the eye of the mind of God, who made the world with its peculiarity, which is all its own, that in the gospel we do so behold God, to the end that we may love God. It is the gospel, and the gospel only, where God stands revealed as an object of confidence to sinners, and where our desire after him is not chilled into apathy by that barrier of human guilt which blocks every approach that is not made to God through the appointed mediator, Jesus Christ. Preaching the Bible is a bringing in of this better hope, Christ, in the gospel, whereby we draw near unto God, or to love God. And to live without the hope of Christ and the gospel is to live without God, without the love for God. And if the heart be without God, then the world will have all the ascendancy. God is apprehended by the believer as God in Christ, who alone can remove the world from this ascendancy in the affections of the heart. It is when God stands dismantled of the terrors which belong to him as an offended lawgiver, propitiated by the mediator Christ's substitutionary death alone, and when we are enabled by faith, which is God's own gift, to see his glory in the face of Jesus Christ and to hear his calling voice as it solemnly declares goodwill to men and entreats the repentance of all who will come to a full pardon and a gracious acceptance. It is then that a love supreme to the love of the world, and at length expulsive of it, the love of the world, first arises in the regenerated heart. It is then released from the spirit of bondage with which the love of God cannot dwell. And when admitted into the number of God's children through the faith that is in Christ Jesus, the spirit of adoption is poured upon us in regeneration. It is then that the heart, brought under the mastery of one great and predominant affection, is delivered from the tyranny of its former desires in the only way in which deliverance is possible. And that faith which is revealed to us from heaven as indispensable to a sinner's justification in the sight of God is also the instrument of the greatest of all moral and spiritual achievements on a nature that is dead to the influence of men and beyond the reach of every other application in the preaching of the worthlessness of the world. Thus, may we come to perceive what it is that makes the most effective kind of preaching. It's not enough to hold out to the world's eye the mirror of its own imperfections. It is not enough to come forth with a demonstration, however pathetic, of the vanishing character of all its enjoyments. It is not enough to travel the walk of experience along with you and speak to your own conscience and your own recollection of the deceitfulness of the heart and the deceitfulness of all that the heart is set upon. There is many a bearer of the gospel message who don't have shrewdness of natural discernment enough and who don't have power of characteristic description enough and who don't have the talent of moral delineation enough to present you with a vivid and faithful sketch of the existing follies of society. And this is what Chalmers describes as what an untalented preacher can do. But the very corruption that he doesn't have the faculty of representing in its visible details, he does have the ability to practically be the instrument of eradicating the object of its affection. So this is what an untalented preacher is able to do, even if we're not very smart or very charismatic. We have the ability, because we have the gospel, to be the instrument of presenting the eradicating object of the empty affections of the heart that go after the world. Chalmers goes on, let him be but a faithful expounder. Let the preacher be but a faithful expounder of the gospel testimony, unable as he may be to apply a descriptive hand to the character of the present world. Let him but report with accuracy the matter which revelation has brought to him from a distant world, unskilled as he is in the work of so dissecting the heart as with the power of a novelist to create a graphical or impressive exhibition of the worthlessness of its many affections, let him only deal with those mysteries of peculiar doctrine on which the best of novelists have thrown the excessiveness of their ridicule. He may not be able, with the eye of shrewd and satirical observation, to expose to the ready recognition of his hearers the desires of worldliness. But with the tidings of the gospel in commission, he may wield the only engine that can destroy them. He cannot do what some have done when, as if by the hand of a magician, they have brought out to view from the hidden recesses of our nature the foibles and lurking appetites which belong to it. But he has a truth in his possession, which into whatever heart it enters will, like the rod of Aaron, swallow up them all. And unqualified as he may be to describe the old man in all the nicer shading of his natural and constitutional varieties, with him is deposited that ascendant influence under which the leading tastes and tendencies of the old man are destroyed, and he becomes a new creature in Jesus Christ our Lord. Let us not cease then to use the only instrument of powerful and positive operation, the preaching of Jesus Christ and of his gospel, to do away from you the love of the world. Let us try every legitimate method of finding access to your hearts for the love of him who is greater than the world. For this purpose, let us, if possible, clear away that shroud of unbelief which so hides and darkens the face of God. Let us insist on his claims to your affection. And whether in the shape of gratitude or in the shape of worth, let us never cease to affirm that in the whole of that wondrous outward operation of the gospel, God's purpose to reclaim a sinful world unto himself, he, the God of love, so sets himself forth in characters of care that nothing but faith and nothing but understanding are lacking on your part to call forth the love of your hearts back again to God. And here let us advertise to the unbelief of a worldly man, when he brings his own sound and secular experience to bear upon the high doctrines of Christianity, when he looks on regeneration as a thing impossible, when feeling as he does the stubbornness of his own heart on the side of things present, when he casts an intelligent eye, much exercised perhaps in the observation of human life, on the equal stubbornness of all who are around him, he pronounces this whole matter about the crucifixion of the old man and the rising of a new man in his place to be in downright opposition to all that is known and witnessed of the real nature of humanity. We think that we have seen such men who, firmly trenched in their own vigorous and homebred discernment, who are shrewdly observant of all that passes before them through the week, and who upon the scenes of ordinary business, we have seen such men who look on that transition of the heart by which it gradually dies unto time and awakens in all the life of a new felt and ever-growing desire towards God as a mere speculation. For when the church gathers a few hours once a week on Sunday, and these unbelieving worldly men thus, with all their attention engrossed upon the concerns of earthliness, continue unmoved in the end of their days amongst the feelings, the appetites, and the pursuits of earthliness. If the thought of death and another state of being after death comes across to them at all, it is not with a change so radical as that of being born again, regenerated, that they ever connect the idea of preparation for what is to come. Unbelievers have some vague idea or thought of its being quite enough that they judge themselves free in some decent and tolerable way of their relative obligations, and that upon the strength of some such social and domestic moralities as are often realized by him into whose heart the love of God has never entered, they will be transplanted in safety from this world, where God is the being with whom it may almost be said that they have had nothing to do, to that world where God is the being with whom they will have mainly and immediately to do throughout all eternity. Note the incapability and contradictory thinking here. They admit all that is said of the utter vanity of time when taken up as a resting place, but they resist every application made upon the heart of man with a view so shifting the heart's affections and inclinations that it shall not from here forward find in the interest of time all its rest and all its refreshment. They in fact regard such an attempt to find rest in the passing of time as an enterprise that is altogether aerial or high or pie in the sky by and by, an empty hope, and with a tone of secular wisdom caught from the familiarities of everyday experience, they see a visionary character in all that is said, of setting our affections on the things that are above, and of walking by faith, and of keeping our hearts in such a love of God as shall shut out from them the love of the world, and of having no confidence in the flesh, and of so renouncing earthly things as to have our conversation in heaven. Now, it is altogether worthy of being said of unbelievers who thus distaste spiritual Christianity, and in fact deem it as incapable of being practiced, how much a piece of their unbelief about the demands of Christianity and their unbelief about the doctrines of Christianity are mixed together with one another. It's no wonder that they only feel the work of the New Testament beyond their strength, as long as they hold the words of the New Testament to be beneath their attention. Neither unbelievers nor anyone else can dispossess the heart of an old affection, but by the expulsive power of a new affection. And if that new affection be the love of God, neither they nor anyone else can be made to receive it, but only on such an influence of God as shall draw the heart of the sinner towards himself. Now it is just their unbelief which screens from the discernment of their minds this influence of God. They do not see the love of God in sending his Son unto the world. They do not see the expression of God's tenderness to men in not sparing Jesus, but giving him up unto death for us all. They do not see the sufficiency of the atonement or the sufferings that were endured by Jesus, who bore the burden that sinners should have borne. They do not see the blended holiness and compassion of the Godhead, in that he passed by the transgressions of his creatures, yet could not pass them by without an expiation in Jesus Christ alone. It's a mystery to unbelievers how a man should pass to the state of godliness from a state of wickedness. But had they only a believing view of God manifest in the flesh, the incarnation of Jesus Christ, this would resolve for them the whole mystery of godliness. As it is, unbelievers cannot get quit of their old affections because their old affections are out of sight from all those biblical truths which have influence to raise a new affection. They are like the children of Israel in the land of Egypt when required to make bricks without straw. They cannot love God while they lack the only food which can disease or unrest this old affection in a sinner's bosom. And however great their errors may be both in resisting the demands of the gospel as incapable of being performed, and in rejecting the doctrines of the gospel as illegitimate, yet there is not a spiritual man, and it's prerogative of him who is spiritual to judge all men, who will not perceive that there is a consistency in these errors. But if there's a consistency in the errors of unbelievers, likewise, there's a consistency in the biblical truths which are opposite to them. The man who believes in the peculiar doctrines of the Bible will readily bow to the peculiar demands of Christianity. When a believer is told to love God supremely, this may startle another, but it will not startle him to whom God has been revealed in peace and in pardon, and in all the freeness of an offered reconciliation in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. When told to shut out the world from his heart, this may be impossible with him who has nothing to replace it, but it is not impossible with him who has found God as sure and satisfying portion. When told to withdraw his affections from the things that are beneath, that is in the world, this is laying an order of self-extenetic, which probably means the former movement of works, removing an order of works upon the man, who knows not another quarter in the whole sphere of his contemplation to which he could transfer his affections. But it is not grievous to him whose view has been opened up to the loveliness and glory of the things that are above, and can there find for every feeling of his soul a most generous and delighted occupation. When told to look not to the things that are seen and temporal, this is blotting out the light of all that is visible from the prospect of him in whose eye there is a wall of partition between guilty nature and the joys of eternity. But he who believes that Christ hath broken down this wall finds a gathering radiance upon his soul as he looks onwards in faith to the things that are unseen and eternal. Tell a man to be holy and how he can navigate such a performance when his only fellowship with holiness is a fellowship of despair. It is the atonement of the cross, reconciling the holiness of the lawgiver, God, with the safety of the offender, us, that hath opened the way for a sanctifying influence into the sinner's heart, and man can take a kindred impression from the character of God now brought near and now at peace with him. Separate the demand from the doctrine, and you have either a system of righteousness that is impracticable or a barren orthodoxy. Bring the demand and the doctrine together, and the true disciple of Christ is able to do the one through the other, strengthening him. The motive or affection is adequate to the movement of obedience, and the offered obedience of the gospel is not beyond the measure of his strength, just because the doctrine of the gospel is not beyond the measure of his acceptance. The shield of faith and the hope of salvation and the word of God and the girdle of truth, these are the armor that a believer has put on, and with these the battle is won, and the height is reached, and the man stands on the vantage ground of a new field and a new extensive view. The effect is great, but the cause is equal to it. And stupendous as this moral resurrection to the commands of Christianity undoubtedly is, there is an element of strength enough to give it being and continuance in the principles of Christianity. The object of the gospel is both to pacify the sinner's conscience and to purify his heart. And it is of importance to observe that what mars the one of these objects mars the other also. The best way of casting out an impure affection is to admit a pure one, and by the love of what is good, to expel the love of what is evil. Thus it is that the freer the gospel, the more sanctifying is the gospel, and the more the gospel is received as a doctrine of grace, the more it will be felt as a doctrine leading to godliness. This is one of the secrets of the Christian life, that the more a man holds of God as a pensioner, a provider, a giver of payment and favor, the greater is the payment of the service that he renders back again. On the tenure of do this and live, A spirit of fearfulness is sure to enter, and the jealousies of a legal bargain chase away all confidence from the intercourse between God and man, and the creature striving to be square and even with his Creator is in fact pursuing all the while his own selfishness instead of God's glory. And with all the conformities which he labors to do, the soul of obedience is not there. The mind is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed under such an outward working will there ever be. It is only when, as in the gospel, acceptance is bestowed as a present, a free gift, without money and without price, that the security which man feels in God is placed beyond the reach of disturbance, or that he can rest in God as one friend finds rest in another, or that any liberal and generous understanding can be established between them, the one party rejoicing over the other to do him good, the other finding that the truest gladness of his heart lies in the impulse of a gratitude by which it is awakened to the charms of a new moral existence. Salvation by grace, salvation by free grace, salvation not of works, but according to the mercy of God. Salvation on such a footing is not more necessary to the deliverance of our persons from the hand of justice than it is to the deliverance of our hearts from the chill and the weight of ungodliness. Retain a single shred or fragment of legality with the gospel, and we raise a topic of distrust between man and God. We take away from the power of the gospel to melt and to reconcile. For this purpose, the freer the gospel is, the better the gospel is. That very peculiarity which so many dread as the germ of antinomianism, or lawlessness, is in fact the germ of a new spirit and a new inclination against it. Along with the light of a free gospel, does there enter the love of the gospel, which in proportion as we impair the freeness of the gospel, we are sure to chase the gospel away. And never does the sinner find within himself so mighty a moral transformation as when, under the belief that he is saved by grace, he feels constrained thereby to offer his heart a devoted thing and to deny ungodliness. To do any work in the best manner, we should make use of the fittest tools for it. Our text again is 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. And we trust that what has been said may serve in some degree for the practical guidance of those who would like to reach the great moral achievement of our text, but feel that the tendencies and desires of nature are too strong for them. We know of no other way by which to keep the love of the world out of our heart than to keep in our hearts the love of God, and no other way by which to keep our hearts in the love of God than by building ourselves upon our most holy faith. That denial of the world, which is not possible to him that disagrees or departs from the gospel testimony, is possible even as all things are possible to him that believes. To try this without faith is to work without the right tool of the right instrument. But faith works by love, and the way of expelling from the heart the love which goes beyond God's law is to admit into its receptacles the love of Christ, which fulfills the law. Conceive a man to be standing on the margin of this green world, and that when he looked towards it, he saw abundance smiling upon every field, and all the blessings which earth can afford scattered in large quantity throughout every family, and the light of the sun sweetly resting upon all the pleasant habitations, and the joys of human companionship brightening many a happy circle of society. Conceive this to be the general character of the scene upon one side of his thoughts, and that on the other, beyond the verge of the godly planet on which he was situated, he could catch sight of nothing but a dark and fathomless unknown. Do you think that he would bid a voluntary goodbye to all the brightness and all the beauty that were before him upon earth and commit himself to the rightful solitude away from it? Would he leave its peopled dwelling places and become a lonely wanderer through the fields of non-entity? If space offered him nothing but a wilderness, would he for it abandon the homebred scenes of life and of cheerfulness that lay so near and exerted such a power of urgency to keep him? Would not he cling to the regions of sense and of life and of society, and shrinking away from the desolation that was beyond it, would he not be glad to keep his firm footing on the territory of this world and to take shelter under the silver canopy that was stretched over it? But if during the time of his thoughts some happy island of the people of God had floated by, and there had burst upon his senses the light of its surpassing glories and its sounds of sweeter melody, and he clearly saw that there a purer beauty rested upon every field, a more heartfelt joy spread itself among all the families, and he could discern there a peace and a reverent awe and a goodness which put a moral gladness into every heart and united the whole society in one rejoicing sympathy with each other and with the good Father of them all. Could he further see that pain and death were there unknown, and above all, that signals of welcome were hung out, and an avenue of communication was made for him? Do you not perceive that what was before the wilderness would become the land of invitation, and that now the world would be the wilderness? What unpeopled space could not do can be done by space teeming with beautiful scenes and beautiful society. And let the existing tendencies of the heart be what they may to the scene that is near and visibly around us, still, if another stood revealed to the sight of man, either through the channel of faith or through the channel of his senses, then, without violence done to the constitution of his moral nature, may he die unto the present world and live to the lovelier world that stands in the distance away from it.